This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Washington lawmakers take up a more than $500 billion military spending bill and begin to consider a range of amendments covering military action in Syria, drone surveillance, and releasing Guantanamo detainees. New York launches a program to provide legal and educational support for young immigrants who qualify for deferred action. And we'll go to Zimbabwe, where LGBT activists face severe risks and retaliation in their push for equality and rights. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. A Yemeni journalist in prison since 2010 was freed today. Abdullah Hedasheya was reunited with his wife and children following his release. Sheya exposed the United States' role in a 2009 airstrike that killed 35 women and children. He also wrote about the drone war for Al Jazeera and the Washington Post. He was charged with supporting al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and sentenced to 5 years in prison in what press advocates called a sham trial. Shortly after his sentencing and amid public outcry, he was pardoned. But Yemeni-American organizer Ruj al-Wazir explains that he wasn't immediately released.
When then-President Saleh pardoned him, it was clear that Sheya was still in prison because of Obama, because the next day, immediately, President Saleh got a call from President Obama himself demanding that Sheya go back into prison.
Sheya's story features prominently in Jeremy Scahill's book and subsequent documentary, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano is in the border city of Matamoros today as part of her final trip to Mexico before stepping down from her cabinet position. Shannon Young reports from Laredo.
Today's meeting between DHS Secretary Napolitano and Mexican Interior Secretary Miguel Ángel Osorio Chong takes place in the offices of one of the bridges connecting Brownsville and Matamoros and is reportedly focused on border security. The event was only publicly confirmed over the weekend, and the complete agenda of the meeting was not fully disclosed to the media beforehand. The meeting comes as the U.S. Congress mulls an immigration reform package, which could allot billions of dollars for technology and surveillance for the border region. It's also on the heels of the arrest of a major cartel boss who is wanted in the U.S. The choice of venues for the meeting is also of note. Earlier this month, the U.S. State Department updated its travel advisory for Mexico, issuing strong warnings about the state of Tamaulipas, where Matamoros is located. The warning revealed restrictions in place on the movements of U.S. government employees in the Mexican border state, including nighttime curfews. Napolitano will travel to Mexico City Wednesday to hold further meetings with Mexican cabinet officials. Shannon Young, FSRN, Laredo.
Immigration authorities in the U.K. kicked off a massive campaign to arrest and deport thousands of migrants in the country. Now they are deploying a mobile billboard campaign aimed at undocumented immigrants. Francis Ngwa reports from Liverpool.
The box trucks will drive through areas that are heavily populated by immigrant communities and are emblazoned with graphics that say, "In the UK illegally, go home or face arrest." The huge posters displayed on the sides of the trucks also note the number of illegal people who were deported and provides contact information for voluntary return. In addition to the mobile and advertisement trucks, leaflets and posters are being distributed. Member of Parliament Sarah Teta criticized the mobile billboards advertising campaign, calling the program nothing less than straightforward intimidation. She accused ministers of creating an anti-immigration rhetoric. But Immigration Minister Mark Harper said the campaign offers undocumented migrants an alternative to being led away in handcuffs. And Home Office officials say voluntary returns are the most cost-effective method of deportation. Francis Ngwa, FSRN, Liverpool.
Protests on the first day of the Pope's visit to Brazil turned violent last night, and the police dispersed the crowd with tear gas. Sam Cowie reports from Rio de Janeiro.
About 1,500 protesters gathered outside of Rio State Government headquarters yesterday as Pope Francisco met with Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff and heads of state. Gay rights groups were heavily present in the crowd. Others demanded the impeachment of State Governor Sergio Cabral, while many rallied against the high costs of hosting the Pope for Rio's World Youth Day. Altogether, the Pope's week in Brazil is estimated to cost the public more than $50 million. Wagner Hilmer, a schoolteacher, asked that the Pope tell the President to invest more in public services.
I want the Pope to say to the President that we need less taxes and expenditures, and more health and education. The country needs this.
Rows of riot police and an armored vehicle prevented the protesters from getting near the building. Violence started when a bottle of water was thrown at the police. Officers dispersed the crowd with tear gas, sound bombs, and rubber bullets, later telling news agencies that they retaliated only after they were attacked with Molotov cocktails. At least four people were treated at a hospital, two for rubber bullet wounds. Sam Cowie, Free Speech Radio News, Brazil.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington, the House took up a more than $500 billion military spending bill today, which could fund the Pentagon and all related agencies for the year 2014. Over the next few days, representatives will consider at least 100 amendments. Some of them aim to release cleared detainees from their indefinite detention at Guantanamo Bay, block funding for military action in Syria, ban the use of drones for domestic surveillance, and defund programs that allow the government to spy on American citizens. As Congress also debates deep cuts to food stamps, education, and affordable housing, many progressive lawmakers and policy advocates say the increases in war and weapons spending show misplaced national priorities. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The House version of the 2014 military spending bill sets aside far more money for weapons, overseas wars, and foreign infrastructure than either the president or the military itself requested. Angela Canterbury, with a project on government oversight, highlighted a few areas where she says spending is particularly wasteful.
The appropriators in Congress decided to provide $1.5 billion more than the Pentagon said it needed for the overseas contingency operations, which is one of the funds for Iraq and Afghanistan spending. And of course, as we're drawing down in those areas, one would presume that we would be decreasing spending. We think that part of that is because there are big moneyed special interests, namely defense contractors who have been lobbying to keep their contracts.
And even as U.S. troops pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan, the government is considering involvement in new battles. Senators Carl Levin and John McCain wrote to U.S. General Martin Dempsey last week, asking him to describe different options for intervening militarily in Syria. In a reply released publicly on Monday, Dempsey outlined several possibilities, including training and advising opposition forces at a cost of $500 million a year, implementing a no-fly zone that would cost $1 billion a month, or conducting limited strikes on the government's military, which he estimates would cost in the billions. About that option, Dempsey also noted that there is a, quote, probability for collateral damage impacting civilians and foreigners inside the country. A proposed amendment to the appropriations bill would bar the president from implementing any of these options without approval from Congress, citing the administration's previous unilateral decision to conduct strikes in Libya. Critics of foreign military aid also sponsored amendments to block any funding of military or paramilitary operations in Egypt and significantly cut back military aid to Pakistan. The list of more than 100 amendments to the bill also includes measures curtailing domestic wiretapping and drone surveillance by defunding certain intelligence programs. On Tuesday, Massachusetts Democrat Jim Moran blasted House Republicans for limiting the debate time on all these amendments to less than 15 minutes each and refusing to hold a vote on many others.
We need to talk about Syria, whether we're going to get sucked into another war. Multiple amendments were offered. All of them were denied except one that basically reinstates current law. There are issues about Egypt that ought to be discussed on the floor. And when I hear my colleagues say, oh, these are sensitive issues, we shouldn't talk about them on the floor, then where should we talk about them?
Moran also criticized his colleagues for proposing more money for things like nuclear submarines and armed drones so soon after demanding massive cuts to food stamps, preschool, and low-income housing.
In reality, it's those painful and draconian cuts in the other appropriations bills that allow this defense bill to emerge relatively unscathed.
The military spending bill also continues the ban on transferring any detainees from Guantanamo, either to the U.S. for trial or to be released in another country. New York Democrat Gerald Nadler introduced an amendment to counteract this provision, which would make the U.S. release more than 85 detainees who have been cleared by the government. The Senate will hold a hearing on this and other efforts to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center on Wednesday. Citing the provision's continuing indefinite detention at Guantanamo, among other concerns, President Obama threatened to veto this military spending bill. But lawmakers and human rights advocates remain skeptical, as he made similar threats in past years and still ended up signing those bills. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Farm workers in Washington have restarted a work stoppage, citing hostile working conditions in the fields and low wages. Workers at Sakuma Brothers Farms in Burlington, Washington, say that they've launched a second stoppage because some workers have faced retaliation after walking off the job earlier this month, and that most of their demands have not been met. It's the peak season for berries, and Sakuma Farms is a major supplier to Häagen-Dazs ice cream. For more, we're joined by Rosalinda Guillen, Executive Director with the group Community to Community Development. She's been working with the farm workers. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Give us the latest at the labor camp at the farm. How many workers are participating? What's the situation like today?
We have a total of 240 workers participating in this action at Sakuma Farm. And this morning we have been meeting with the workers and with management at Sakuma Farms again, trying to negotiate return to work, trying to negotiate wages.
And workers have released a list of 14 demands. Some of them include securing overtime pay, adequate child care, eliminating intimidation from supervisors, stopping the practice of being forced to work when sick. What demands have been met and what's left?
Well, I think the most important one was the one they started out with, which was an unjust firing of one of the workers for asking for a higher wage per pound when they were picking blueberries. And so he asked for a higher wage, and they fired him, and the workers all walked off the field demanding that they hire him back, but then also that they respect his demand, which was to raise the price per pound because people were not earning enough money picking blueberries at 30 cents a pound. So that demand was met after two sessions with the management. And those sessions, some of them were pretty heated, pretty loud, because we had over 200 workers negotiating. Quickly, the entire unit elected a committee, a representative committee of 11 of their colleagues, of the co-workers. And then they continued with the negotiation about abusive and disrespectful supervisor that was supervising their crew, and they would not budge from to the discussion on wages or returning back to work until that supervisor was either fired or transferred from their crew. So what the workers have negotiated is basically a committee, a subcommittee, to work with operations manager on determining their wages.
So this is a process where the workers themselves are participating or would participate in setting that wage and what is a fair wage for the work that they're participating in. Is that right? They would actually participate in that. And how does that work?
Well, each block or each field of blueberries is different from the other. They all ripen at different times or slightly different times. There's different varieties of blueberries. Therefore, the quantity and the quality of the blueberry is different in each field. So they do test picks to try to determine speed and quality and quantity and how long it takes workers to pick, to meet minimum wage, which is $9.19 a pound in Washington State.
The workers that are at the farm, tell us about who they are, where they're from, and how that influences and contributes to this process.
The majority of those workers are Triqui and Mixteco. They're indigenous from Oaxaca and Guerrero. They are migrant workers that do a migrant circuit, as near as we can tell. Most of them are from California. They come from California to pick the blueberry harvest at Sukuma Farms. Many of them have been coming for years to Burlington, Washington. They are traveling in family groups, which is a, you know, these are family groups. So you've got families at the labor camp that travel together, extended relatives and relatives. So, and some of the people come from the same towns. So I think that that makes a big difference into how these workers see themselves and how they negotiate and how they see the company. They are an extremely honorable and committed group. They believe when they give their word, they keep their word. And so they expect that when other people give their word, they should keep their word. And that is the values and principles that they're using in this negotiation.
Just going back to that central demand or that original demand of the rate that is paid, talk about the difference between the piece rate versus hourly wage and how that is factoring into the negotiations.
Well, the piece rate, basically they set a price per pound. And so a worker has to pick a certain number of pounds in order to make minimum wage. It's illegal to work to pay a worker less than minimum wage. And so in order for a worker to make a lot of money, he has to be extremely fast and pick really fast in order to earn minimum wage or higher. There are some workers that at times earn $28 an hour, which sounds like a lot. And the workers say it's great, but it's such a short period of time because of the way the harvests are. And again, the quality and the quantity of the blueberry is what determines how many pounds they're going to pick. And so they were willing to give up those short periods of time of earning up to $28 an hour for a stable wage through the harvest, as long as they were allowed to work 8 to 10 hours a day.
And has Sukuma Farms made that an option on the table about the hourly rate?
It's on the table and it's being discussed. And so that's where we're at today. We probably won't know until the end of the day or tomorrow.
That's Rosalinda Guillen, Executive Director with the group Community to Community Development. She joined us from Burlington, Washington, where farm workers on Sukuma Farms have launched a work stoppage. In an effort to help young immigrants who qualify for deferred action, New York City leaders have announced a new program to provide legal and educational support. The move comes as Congress makes little progress on immigration reform and families continue to be split apart by deportations. FSRN's Rebecca Miles has more.
Dolce Rojas Fataro came to New York when she was 8 years old.
I practically grew up here. I went to school. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to continue and graduate high school, but I went back to get the GED because actually it's giving me a better opportunity for the law and to have a better job, career. And also, it's a big example for my kids.
Fataro joined city leaders when they recently announced $18 million in funding to provide adult education classes, expand literacy and employment services, and create legal support systems for undocumented immigrants. City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, who's running as a Democrat for mayor in this year's election, said she hopes the announcement will have an impact outside of New York's five boroughs and will send a message across the nation as well.
That local government can take action while we wait for comprehensive immigration reform.
It's been over a year since President Obama announced the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. Quinn said because of the president's directive, there are real opportunities for young people.
These possibilities exist if they enroll in the right education programs, and if they do, they can qualify for DACA. And through DACA, they're eligible to apply for work authorization, get a driver's license, and the great news is legally stay in this city and in this country.
The fund is part of a plan to help some of the estimated 79,000 New Yorkers who qualify for deferred action. The city will give priority to immigrants in expanded adult education classes for an estimated 16,000 people. The goal is to help immigrants obtain their high school diploma or GED, one of the requirements for deferred action. New York University professor Hiro Yoshikawa says he's researched immigrant families and found that one in three children of immigrants has at least one undocumented parent.
By virtue of being born to a parent without papers, children have lower access in this city, in this country, to the learning opportunities that are linked to their later school success, their earnings, their later economic productivity, and their well-being.
But not all New Yorkers agree. Joanne Marzullo is the president for New Yorkers for Immigration Control and Enforcement.
New York City is facing hard economic times. And our fellow legislators seem to think there are millions, 18 million, to give away to people illegally here. The legal New Yorkers that they are supposed to be working for, the legal New York voters, are facing hard times.
Another program the city is launching will create a public defender system for immigrants facing deportation. City leaders say these efforts to help immigrants are the largest of their kind in the country. Rebecca Miles, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
As we heard in yesterday's program, LGBT rights activists in Cameroon face severe restrictions, and many are calling for justice after a prominent activist and journalist was found dead last week. Today, we continue our look at the challenges that the LGBT community faces in many African countries by going to Zimbabwe, where LGBT people face discrimination, harassment, and attacks. The country's laws criminalize homosexuality, and many LGBT people are driven from their homes through violence or threats of violence. But some activists continue their push for rights. FSRN's Gerikai Chawunza reports.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has fueled prejudice against LGBT people through public statements that endorse discrimination and stigmatization. He has on several occasions described gays as being worse than pigs and dogs, but the discrimination is not limited to public discourse. The country's common laws prohibit sodomy and define it as the unlawful and intentional sexual relations between two males. According to the Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, the criminal law explicitly prohibits consensual sex between adult men but can be applied to any semi-gender couple and includes penalties of fines and even prison. Tondirai Batasara works with the organization Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. He explains how the law is applied.
You see the specific offense is that of sodomy. And it has to be distinguished from being a homosexual or a gay man. You need to have committed the specific offense of sodomy for you to have contravened the law. It will not be enough just for you to be a gay man or a homosexual man.
Batasara has represented the advocacy group Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, or GALS, on several occasions after members were arrested and harassed by the state. One of those is the group's director, Chesterfield Samba. He was at one point picked up from his office, searched and taken to Harare Central Police Station. He was not formally charged before being released. Other GALS members and officials have over the years been raided, arrested and harassed by the police before being freed without charges. Samba says the climate of attacks and repression continues because few are lobbying for equality in the country.
I think the situation that needs to prevail in the country is a situation where everybody speaks to the notion around equality for everyone, regardless of sexual orientation or any other difference whatsoever. And I think that's the position in which so many civil society organizations that try and lobby for human rights, they try and speak on a platform around equality for everybody and human rights for all.
Samba and GALS attempted to gain protections for LGBT people last year during the process of the drafting of a new constitution. The issue sparked debates and even temporarily stopped the process after President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party accused the Morgan Tsvangirai-led MDC of trying to smuggle gay rights in the supreme law of the land. but Samba says they simply want the same protections as everyone else.
Our submission was premised on three issues: the right to privacy, right to equality and non-discrimination, as well as the right to dignity. You'll find that those three elements are now part of the new constitution that we now ushered in as a country. I think where the politicians expressed concerns was around the issue of same-sex marriage, which really wasn't our submission.
The National Constitutional Assembly, or NCA, is a grassroots NGO that formed 15 years ago to help advance human rights in civic issues. The group's spokesperson, Madok Shivasa, says that the recent constitution-making process left out a number of fundamental issues and groups.
The problem with the constitution-making process was also that it was sidelining a lot of people. It would be very difficult for those people in political power to understand them, because these are the people who actually brought the polarization that came when you want to understand the existence of this grouping in Zimbabwe. They made Zimbabweans to think as if when you are talking about gays and lesbians, you are maybe probably talking about whether you want it or not. The issue was for people of Zimbabwe to discuss about the existence of these people and to discuss about, so what can we do about their existence?
The majority of Zimbabweans are Christian, and many faith leaders preach homophobia. Even some of those who disagree with political statements on LGBT issues believe the myth that sexual orientation is a choice. Jairus Masango is a local pastor in Harare.
The bedrock of Christian life is understanding and tolerance. So the way I see it is we should try to look things from their point of view, try to understand where they are coming from, try to understand, you know, really what drove them into homosexuality. Otherwise, I would think the only solution is not to fight, it's not to attack them, but rather to pray for them.
US-based evangelical groups have also advanced anti-gay campaigns in the country. According to the U.S.-based Political Research Associations, a group founded by Pete Robertson, the American Center for Law and Justice has a presence on the ground in Zimbabwe and contributed to the constitution-making process. Although there may be a lack of condemnation of the discrimination and abuses within the country, United Nations Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay challenged Zimbabwe politicians against attacking homosexuals during a visit last year.
There can be no justification for violence, harassment, or stigmatization. And criminalization of any group because of their sexual orientation can lead to impediments to their accessing basic services. In other words, result in clear-cut discrimination, including treatment for HIV.
While campaigning recently in front of thousands of supporters, President Mugabe again made anti-gay statements suggesting the jailing of LGBT people who did not have children, according to New Zimbabwe News. Human rights advocates are calling on Mugabe to immediately cease making statements that vilify or dehumanize the LGBT community. Karikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can check out sights and sounds from FSRN's Global Reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.